Meeting to order. Let's go. We've got a lot to do here. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 3 minutes after 9 a.m. February 16, 2010. We're going to try to start right on time at 9 a.m. We've got about 2 weeks worth of work ahead of us. So with us today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Egan. I expect over the course of the next several weeks, we'll have other legislators coming into the committee room during these proceedings. But I've specifically invited Senator Pascavan to sit in as much as he can afford to share his legal perspective and expertise with me and the committee dealing with some of the technical legal issues dealing with the matters in front of us. Today we'll begin our review of the Alaska oil and gas structure. Over the next 2 weeks, I intend to focus specifically on our production tax so we understand it and so that we can evaluate how it is performing since it was implemented in 2006 and modified in 2007. This morning we're going to set the stage for our tax discussion with a presentation from the Department of Revenue on our oil and gas production forecast. Following that, we'll hear from the Division of Oil and Gas on oil and gas activity in Alaska. If we get through these two topics this morning, we'll move on to the Department of Labor for the discussion of industry employment and resident hiring practices. What we don't finish this morning, we'll pick up beginning at 1:30 this afternoon and run till a maximum of 3 p.m. But we're going to try to start right on time and end on time, so I need to have hopefully four members here promptly at 9 and then promptly at 1:30. We'll finish this afternoon with a discussion of oil transportation costs, also referred to as a downstream cost. These costs include the tariff association with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to ship oil from the North Slope. And today, presenting from the Department of Revenue is Jennifer Duval, petroleum economist from the Department of Revenue Tax Division, I guess is where we're going to start.
That's correct.
So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then take us through the presentation. I'll go ahead and stop you when we have questions from the members of the committee, but we'll try to keep it flowing. So I'll just kind of cue you up to stop when you finish a sentence or a paragraph, and then we'll pick up the questions, because there's, depending on the involvement particular members have had, some of which are new, Senator Egan, we want to make sure that all seven of us are following the presentations along with the public at home. So we'll try to stay away from acronyms and speak in fairly straightforward Alaska language, not oil jargon. And with that, go ahead and start your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jennifer Duval. I am a petroleum economist for the Department of Revenue. And with me is Frank Molly, and he is a petroleum engineer. And he is consulting with the department on the production forecast. My main job with the department is to manage and coordinate the publication of the revenue sources book. But my specific responsibility is the production forecast itself. So this is an outline of what we're going to discuss today. What do we forecast and why? Factors that affect our forecast. We're going to review the Alaska North Slope production profiles, as well as Frank will get into the details of the fall 2009 forecast methodology decline curve analysis and show a little bit of demonstration with some graphs. So what do we forecast? We need to forecast for revenue and budgetary purposes. This chart here is from the Society of Petroleum Engineers. It categorizes reserves versus resources. Reserves are categorized as proved, probable, and possible. The DOR uses similar categorization. However, we use terminology such as currently producing, under development, and under evaluation. And on this chart here, you can see the top rectangle says on production. That would be our currently producing category. Our under development category would be the next three boxes below that or so: approved for development, justified for development, possibly development pending, depending upon the particular project. And our under evaluation would include development pending or potentially unclarified. In the long run, we do consider this forecast to be conservative because we do not include undiscovered or prospective resources, prospects, leads, or plays, and even some development that is on hold. Again, these are our three categories of production and the definitions. Our currently producing includes base production and enhanced recovery production from investment in rate-enhancing activities such as perforations, stimulations, well workovers, gas and water injection support. Currently under development category includes new projects that are currently funded from the producers or awaiting project sanction in the near future. And our under evaluation category includes technically viable projects that are considered the pencil sharpening stage, engineering, cost, risk, and reward are being actively evaluated. They may be unfunded, but are considered to have high chance of being brought to fruition. Here are the factors that we need to consider in production forecasting.
Hold it a minute. Yes. Senator Huggin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jennifer, recently we were going over with Kevin Banks some of the permitting activity, and in 2009 there was like 13 permits, and the year prior there was 33, 39, and 43 as you went back by year. How does the lack of permitting activity affect your forecast?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, it probably depends on the type of permits that you're discussing. If they're exploratory, they may not be in our forecast. They may or may not be in our forecast at all. We tend to put heavy weight on projects that have budget.
Yeah. This is developmental.
So developmental,
right,
permits, then they would be categorized under our under development plan. And we meet with the operators every year to go over their plans, and if there's been a change in their permitting activity, if they've adjusted some their plan of development, then that will be reflected in our forecast.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
So again, here are the factors that affect our forecast, things that we have to consider. The first, of course, is the geology. And these include the rock type, formation characteristics, depth, thickness, pressure, as well as the oil gravity, viscosity, water content, etc. Secondly, the development plan from the operator. These would include the development rate, well density, completion technique, and potential enhanced oil recovery, and their facility and surface operations. The commercial aspects are extremely important. The project economics, oil price and market conditions, as well as government policy, access to land, regulation, and taxation. These three factors would help determine the production profile. We consider the profile looking at the history and the stage of depletion, and use that profile to extrapolate trends going forward. Lastly, timing is very important. How do we schedule the new projects and when they're coming online? That's a very important factor that's very critical and often the reason for inaccurate forecasts. Projects get delayed, so our next round of forecasts, we include the best information we have at the time. I'd like to point out that while we as government have control over some of these factors, we don't have any control over geology, the oil price, market conditions. These are factors that we can't control. So the areas that we can control, obviously government policy, and some of those things can impact the development plan. Here we have graphs of a typical production profile. If you start from a single well on the left there, you can see that production comes on pretty quick in the beginning and comes to a steep decline where it stabilizes. If you add up multiple wells through a whole field, you would get a production profile such as the middle graph, where production increases at first, reaches a peak, and declines. And the decline rate typically levels off in later years. If you sum multiple fields together, you can come up with a profile such as the one on the right, which would be for an entire basin or multiple fields together, and you would have a graph like the one on the right. And as I mentioned before, the geology, the operator's plan of development, and the commercial factors would all influence the shape of this curve, determining the highs and the peaks, as well as how narrow or wide that curve would be. So next we're going to look at how does the North Slope compare to these graphs. And you'll see that they fit this shape pretty well. So here is a production profile of a Prudhoe Bay well. And you can see it fits the profile of a single well that I showed on the previous slide. It came on pretty strong at about 1,400 barrels per day in 2005 and declined to about what we're seeing today is about 450 barrels per day. Now, if we summed up all the wells that have produced historically for Prudhoe, and this is just the Prudhoe Bay field itself, not the unit, the graph on the left there is the entire field. And I also have Kuparik as well. So you can see different points in time where the rate has changed slightly. For example, if you look at Kuparik, right around 1991-92, you can see an additional bump. That was about the time when enhanced oil recovery began. You can also see an additional flattening and further incremental increase right around 95 to 97, and that was when miscible injection began.
And could we get you to define the y-axis?
I'm sorry, the y-axis is in millions of barrels per day. So if we sum up all of the fields that have been currently producing, we get the production profile for the entire Alaska North Slope Basin. The addition of new fields has mitigated this decline. In 2009, Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik alone represented only 57% of total North Slope production. So you can see how the addition of new fields has been important in mitigating that decline. In addition, infill drilling, facility capacity expansions, enhanced oil recovery projects have also helped stem decline.
So when we look at this chart of the history, is this is then typical of oil basins around the world?
Senator, Chairman Stedman, yes, that is correct.
So we shouldn't expect you to go back to, or the industry to go back to 2 million barrels a day?
I would not expect so without a major find.
Okay. and just to try to, I guess, make it a little clearer dealing with the public, there's a lot of comments that we had hit 2 million barrels a day, and now we're substantially less than that, less than 50% of it. But that's a normal decay of an oil field.
Chairman Stedman, that's correct. You can see, for example, the dark purple and light purple sections that indicate Alpine and North Star that came on in about 2000-2001 had a pretty big impact on helping to reduce the production decline during that time. Actually, we saw the only time in history since peak in 1988 when the production rate year over year increased was when those two fields came online. And that's representative of those two fields alone are an addition of more than 775 million barrels of oil recoverable. And that's a lot of oil, and it only stemmed decline a very tiny percent that one time, that one year when they came online. So you have, because Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk account for so much of the basin and the production, you would need a lot, a very large field in order to get back to rates that we've seen historically.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at the, in particular, the Alpine field, it doesn't seem to fit directly into your per well curve on the earlier pages here very well. Is that simply a longer period of development for that one, or am I just referring back to your charts on page 7 and then trying to relate that time-wise, even though you don't have timelines on the bottom there, but you do on the one page showing that it was pretty rapid decline, but this seems to have built for a longer period of time. That's just a the nature of that particular field was a fairly well, fairly good-sized one?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, I think it's a little bit unclear to see. If I graphed Alpine alone, you would probably see that it fits the profile well. I think because we've aggregated this chart as an area curve, and you know, we've layered all of the fields on top of each other, I think that makes it a little difficult to see. But if that's something that you would like to see, I can certainly pull together all of the fields profiles for you at a later time if you would like so.
No, I was trying to just get a feel for, although Prudhoe being an extremely large field, some of the more smaller ones as expected, that's what we're looking for these days, the length of time that we're at least having reasonable production, and then it drops off on either side. So just kind of looking at myself for the number of years, 10 years or so, looks like kind of an average for the higher production of the fields. Again, looking at your chart, which is not that specific to that. Just trying to get a rough idea in my own mind. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Before you continue, Senator Coghill and Senator French have joined us. And we haven't had the opportunity to look through your presentation in advance, so and just glancing through it, it'd be nice if we could get kind of a focus on the last five and the next five in production. I understand we're doing a broad history, both back and forward. So as you continue on, I mean, that's of a particular point of interest to the committee for the next week and a half.
Just some numbers on the production decline. I believe we've shown this before in a previous hearing. Production did peak in 1988, about 2.01 million barrels per day. Fiscal year 2009, that ended this last June, production averaged 693,000 barrels per day. That does represent a 66% decline since that peak. To date, from fiscal year 1988, that average per year decline is about 4.9%. If we just look at the last 10 years, very similar, 4.8%. And I do point out that in fiscal year 07 was the largest, the year with the largest decline. It was about 12.6%, and if we remember, that was the Prudhoe Bay shutdown. So if we excluded that, knowing that that was an outlier, an extraordinary circumstance, the decline is about 4%. And we're forecasting going forward, including all three layers are currently producing under development, under evaluation, the decline rate to flatten out to about 3.6% per year on average. So I think this is getting to the forecast area here, if we put together the history and forecast on the same slide. And this is from our fall 2009 forecast. Through the year, fiscal year 2050, we expect to recover an additional 5.3 billion barrels of oil. As I mentioned before, our forecast does not include projections from the Outer Continental Shelf, the areas such as the Chukchi Sea and Bering Seas. It does not include heavy oil productions from UGNU, as well as most of the heavy oil production from West Sac and Schrader Bluff. It does not include production from ANWR. It includes some production from the NPRA in the known Moose's Tooth unit accumulations, but the rest of NPRA it does not include. It does not include the restart of Badami, which was recently announced, and it does not include the Umiat field. On this chart, there is a field that I've notated in the legend that's called offshore. That refers to Ugarit and Nikichuk. So it does not refer to the offshore continental shelf, Bering Sea, Chukchi Sea.
Okay, if we could have you, unless it's already in the coming attractions of the presentation, and give us some production profiles on heavy oil, particularly heavy oil, obviously in state lands, is what we're after. And its potential impact. We're going to get into later on, we're going to get into the credits. And one of the issues of the credits was to incentivize heavy oil.
Senator Stedman, I don't have any slides prepared specifically on profiles for heavy oil. I can pull the profiles for West Sac and Schrader Bluff for you. There's also some pools in the Prudhoe Bay unit, Orion, Polaris are considered heavier oil as well. I can pull those for you and provide those to you after this presentation. As a reference, some of the statements and news articles regarding heavy oil is somewhere between 20 and 35 billion barrels of oil is about the size of the resource. The recovery, however, for those pools is much lower than some of the lighter oil pools that are currently producing. Studies show somewhere between 2 and maybe 10 or 15% recovery. So out of 20 to 35 billion barrels, you may only be able to recover at current technology somewhere between 2 and 10 or 15% of that. But I can put together some more information if you need that.
Yes, and I think we can have you do that and we can bring it back when we do the credits. We'll have a discussion on the credits and we could roll that kind of together. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've, over the last 24 months, we've heard a lot about offshore, particularly from Shell. And in your forecast, it shows that we could potentially see something in 2012. But how many of those are currently under development, new projects?
Senator Hoffman. Offshore in this slide is referring to Ugarit and Nikichuk. We do not consider any potential from Shell in the Chukchi or Bering Sea.
So where would they be under?
They would not be.
Category three currently under evaluation under your presentation?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, it is not included at all anywhere under any of the three layers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe you can just briefly mention the difference between federal and state waters for those at home that may be watching the show.
Sure, Chairman Stedman. Federal waters is, I believe, beyond the 6 mile limit. Between 3 and 6 miles is considered state waters, and beyond 6 miles is federal. I believe that's correct.
It's 0 and 3, isn't it? 0 and 3 and beyond 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pardon me, I misspoke.
Yeah,
between 0 and 3 is state waters, and 3 to 6 is federal.
Right. We have, for those watching at home, we have from 3 to 200 miles is federal, and we have the inability of sharing our resources with the industry, I guess. The tax scenario doesn't come into play.
Yes.
Go ahead, Marcia, if you want to just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Marcia Davis. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue, and I just wanted to add one element, which is why there's confusion around the 6 mile. The state authority to tax production stops at the 3 mile line. The state authority to receive royalty generally goes out to 3 miles for state leased lands. There is an arrangement for some royalty sharing in the zone between 3 and 6 mile, where the state gets a certain share of federal royalty, and that's where folks get confused over the 6 mile.
Okay, and I think we'll go to Senator Hoffman, and then there was a question, was it Thomas or of you? Okay, then Senator Thomas.
But the reason that I bring up offshore is that although it's the 3 mile and 6 mile doesn't directly impact us, isn't it true that if we get offshore oil going through the pipeline that we could see lower tariffs on the Trans-Alaska pipeline for the rest of the oil that's going through the pipeline for that could benefit Alaska?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that is correct. There, although we may not receive or we won't receive tax revenue from those from offshore federal waters, we certainly can receive benefit through the oil being shipped down through the Trans-Alaska pipeline, as well as possibly being processed through facilities that are on state lands. So the impacts that you may see would show up in an increased wellhead price, because the tariff would be reduced, the Trans-Alaska pipeline tariff would be reduced. But you would also see an additional benefit to income tax, petroleum corporate income tax, as well as property tax. The next slide here just
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was one of my questions, but the other one was in regards to heavy oil. Do you confirm those numbers with the industry as well? Are those something that are basically agreed upon, or you just make up your own mind after some hopefully discussions with them that it's 25 to 30 billion, because that's one of the higher numbers I've heard so far of the potential, at least? Or
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that number that I quoted is from a Department of Energy study that was recently released from the National Energy Technology Laboratories. They did do a study that was originally released in 2007, and an addendum was released recently, I believe in October perhaps. And they go through the resource potential of the Alaska North Slope, and it's a very good, well-written report, and includes potential from other sources that we do not include in our forecast. So if you would like to get an understanding of some other potential that we have not included, such as offshore, ANWR, other state lands, heavy oil deposits, it's an excellent report.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
This next slide is just a little zoomed in from the previous slide of just the forecast. This shows the breakdown between new projects and our currently producing projects. So if there were no additional new oil projects coming online, the area in the gray shaded area would be what we expect the production profile to look like and the decline rate. And that decline rate of that gray area is about 7% per year. So you can see we're expecting some new projects, not just new fields, but additional development at currently producing fields as well to contribute quite a bit to our forecast in the later years. Like I mentioned in the beginning, the timing of these are very important. If we were to go way back to some of our previous forecasts, here's what we were forecasting for production for the current fiscal year 2010. 104,000 barrels per day in the spring of 1989. Spring 1994, 583,000 barrels per day. So you can see in the long run, the timing of some of these projects is very important. And how do we deal with the timing issue? We discuss, we read plans of development that are submitted from the operators. They're submitted annually, and we read them, and they outline what they plan to do for the next year. We also meet with all of the operators and go through and discuss their plans and discuss what are their drilling schedules, when do they plan to have downtime and turnaround and maintenance, and we use that information to help schedule some of these projects. It is important to note, however, that the operators often tell us that all of these things are subject to change, and that, of course, they have to run it by through their partners, and the partners must approve their plans as well.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Jennifer, I appreciate what you're telling us here, and timing is important, and that's one of the things that concerns some people like myself and some of my neighbors, because, as I mentioned earlier about the developmental certifications, if you will, they're down by two-thirds, and which is bad news for the timing that you're mentioning here, in my estimation. But let's turn it around in a positive aspect, because I mean, obviously you're a good professional and you want a bright future for the state. And if you were, I'll use the term queen for a day in Alaska, and you wanted this new production to come online in good timing, based on things that you look at from your economic perspective and your credentials, what three things would you do to incentivize new development, new production? And I'll sweeten that real quick, because it was interesting. I read a proposal by a member in the other body about a tax holiday for new production, new development. But I would enjoy your thoughts on three things that would brighten our future going forward as far as incentives to make those kinds of things happen.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I don't think my role is to discuss policy issues, but if you were to go back to the beginning of the slide where I mentioned those factors, or the beginning of the presentation with the factors we have control over, access, regulation, and taxation. Those are the factors that we have control over. So factors that would help speed that up would be increasing access, reducing inefficiencies in regulations, making permit process easier, and providing for tax incentives, whatever they may be. I don't want to get into the policy of which tax incentives are better than others, but those are the three categories that you can effectively have control over.
Thank you very much.
We're getting a little off track. The intent of the hearings the next week and a half is to try to drill down into that, but clearly some of the folks doing your presentations aren't in the policy-making business, so we'll have some of this stuff default out, hopefully, at the end. we can go ahead and continue.
Okay. So next, Mr. Molly is going to discuss how he pulls together all of the data and information and puts together our forecast.
Good morning. My name is, for the record, my name is Frank Molly. I'm president of Molly Computer Services, and I'm on contract to work with the Department of Revenue. Today, we're going to go through a little class, and I'm going to try to explain how we generated the forecast this year. Basically, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission maintains monthly production data for every well in the state. What we do is gather this data from the state and put it into a decline curve. Okay, and what is a decline curve? And that's our little class today. We're going to try to teach you how to do this. If you plot production data on a graph that's you're probably all familiar with, a linear graph, as we would call it, it's going to look something like this. And you can see at the left there around the year 2005, the production peaked at around 1,400 in this particular well, which is a Prudhoe Bay well. And the current production is about 450 barrels of oil per day. If you look at the scale on the left-hand side, it goes from 0 to 1,500. This is called a linear scale. What we do as engineers is we plot things on a log scale. And if you look at the next page, the log scale is a bit different than the linear scale. And it starts at 100 and goes to 1,000 there in the center and then up to 10,000. If you look at the 1,000 line, that's 1,000 barrels of oil per day. The next line above that would be 2,000, and then the next line above that would be 3,000. That's the only difference that between this and a linear scale. The reason we do this, it may become obvious, is if you plot oil production on a log scale like this, you get regions that are fairly linear. So if you look at the time frame from, say, about 2006 forward, that's a fairly linear linear series of data. And you can see here the production, if you read the numbers right, the production started peaked at about 1,400 and ended up at about 450. If we go to the next scale, what we do with a decline curve is we draw a line through that linear section of data and use that to project the oil production, oil and gas production out. This is done for every well in the state of Alaska, every producing well in the state of Alaska. If I take this data and move it back to a linear scale, and this is the one that we're all used to, it looks something like this.
If we could just stop there.
Sure.
One of the issues that we're struggling with is the impact of going from a tax and royalty system to a production sharing arrangement where we have capital credit incentives to increase production. So this is a little more, I guess, detailed than the previous chart, zeroing in on that time frame. But it doesn't appear that there's been any increase in production or any
Senator,
alterations in that.
Senator Stedman, this is just a single well production. This would not be the entire field. We'll get to that in a few slides here. And that may be a little bit more obvious then. Where investments might affect production. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is a Kuparik River well, a single well. And is this method perfect? Is this decline method perfect? It's not. If you look at this particular well, and say we went way back in time to the year rate, say 2002, and we had no data from there on out, if I were to draw a decline curve at that time, this is what the line would look like. So having projected it from that point forward, you can see that that projection would be a bit low in this case. This is another well, and this is a...
If you could just hold it a minute. Senator mm-hmm. Egan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frank, at what rate, I'm just looking at this Kuparik, at what rate on this one particular well do they have to shut it down because it's getting...
uneconomic?
Yeah.
Senator Egan, through the chair, I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that question. It would depend on a lot of factors. I'm sure there would be considerations of other producing wells in the area, so that if this is producing into a facility, they might need to keep that facility running. And this, even though it might be uneconomic individually, they may decide to keep this running to keep the facility able to process the oil and gas from this. So
there's no specific figure then.
Not that I'm aware of, sir.
Individual well.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
This is another Prudhoe Bay well, and as you can see, the trend from 2001 through 2010, the production data is a bit ratty there, but we can still discern a trend here, and we can still project the production of the well using this decline curve method. So to generate a field forecast, what we do is we upload production from the AOGCC from every well, we apply a decline curve to every well, and then we sum all of that production, and we produce a field curve. And this is the Prudhoe Bay, the IPA, and this is the decline curve that we generated from summing all of the individual wells of the field. The red line here represents the projection of the currently producing wells. So for every all the equipment and all the facilities we have out there, this is the production we would expect for the currently producing equipment production. Basically, if you look to the left, the decline rate on this particular in the Prudhoe Bay is about 6%, and we projected the forecast to be about 6% of the currently producing data.
So in your analysis, did you see any change in the data on the last 3 years when we implemented a different tax regime with credits available? Or could you even tell in your forecasting that there was any fiscal regime change from a statistician's point of view?
The last 3 years of production on Prudhoe Bay does show a change in slope. If you look on the graph from 2010 back, the last 3 years or so, it looks like it had flattened out quite a bit. And I don't know if that's a result of a tax regime, but it's a result of the gas cap water injection that the company proceeded with around that time.
Briefly explain what that is? You just mentioned the gas cap.
Well, an oil reservoir typically has an oil layer and a gas layer above that. In order to maintain pressure in the reservoir to keep the production profile, keep the production rates up, they'll inject water into the gas cap, and that adds pressure to the reservoir, and it maintains the production rates for the oil wells. So it sort of pushes the oil out, the gas down and the oil out, so to speak.
Okay. And then there's a spike down in year 5 or 6 or somewhere. It's hard to tell. What's that spike down?
I believe that was a pipeline issue for Prudhoe Bay. Am I right, Jenny?
That's correct. Okay. About 2006, you see a little bit of a drop here from the time that wells were shut in.
Okay, so the red line, if we go to the next graph, the red line represents the currently producing wells. The green line then would represent the currently producing wells plus any production we've forecasted from the projects that are under development. And these have a fairly good chance of coming to fruition. So you can see in this case that the added investment of these projects are going to significantly increase the production rates and maintain it for quite a bit longer. Go ahead and to the next slide, Jenny. This is the Kuparik River field, and you can see that the decline rate there we historically was about 7%, and we project it to be about the same. Again, the red and green lines here indicate, the red indicates the currently producing wells, and the green indicate the underdevelopment wells. One other thing about these decline curves is a straight line trend on this indicates a constant percentage decline. So if you were to take a 10% decline per year, it would create a straight line on this graph.
So could we have you come back with a committee with these charts focused? I guess you can start at the year 2000, make it easy, and shoot it forward to 2015 and pick up Prudhoe, Kuparik, and Alpine.
I'm sorry, sir.
Prudhoe, Kuparik, and Alpine fields with these production charts that you have here, combine the three of those, maybe, because you've got Prudhoe and Kuparik, put Alpine on here, and then the three, and then do it from 2000 to 2020 or 2015.
Senator, yes, we could produce that chart for you. I don't have it here. Right. We do have the total north slope and following charts, but
right. If you can get that back to the committee, because that'll help us with our discussion coming up.
Okay.
With credits.
And again, this
well,
is
if
a
we could.
Sorry.
Well, I have that thought, and if you could, once you separate Prudhoe, Kuparik, and Alpine. Might as well throw in another chart to combine everybody else.
We do have a chart that combines the total north slope here and a few more here.
Separate.
Okay.
Prudhoe, Kuparik, and Alpine is one unit. Everybody else is another unit.
Okay. We can do that, Senator.
Okay.
This is a map, obviously, of the north slope, and again, we did not forecast areas such as the ANWR or the most of the NPRA, the foothills, and some other places, West Sac and Schrader Bluff, the heavy oil, and those. Now go ahead.
If we took this chart and redid it, and took these fields where we've got Kuparik and Prudhoe and Alpine and in green and West or West Sac, if we change the chart around and just put it on dollars, where the revenue generation is that something that can be done by the department, or how would we go about getting that?
Perhaps, Senator Stedman, I don't know. I'll have to look into the data to see how we can best graphically display that, but I think we can pull something together.
Right. The point is, where's the revenue to the Treasury? That's the
definitely Prudhoe, Kuparik,
and Alpine.
Alpine, North Star.
Right.
Certainly.
Okay, if we look at this graph, this is a graph of the total north slope production, again on the log scale. And if you look at the area between around 1995 to 2000, the decline rate there was 6%. And if you look at the area, say, after 2004 to pretty much current time, the decline rate again was 6%. If you look in between there, from about 2000 out to 2004 or so, the decline rate stopped. Why is that? Well, during that time, we had six fields come online and on production. There's seven fields, actually. Polaris, Alpine, Aurora, Borealis, Meltwater, North Star, and Orion. So you can see whenever new production does come on, you can mitigate the decline somewhat in an overall basis. And again, this is the total north slope. The red line indicates the currently producing, and the green line would indicate the currently producing plus the under development projects in this case. The decline rates historically have been roughly 6%. Out in the future, we're looking at probably about 4%, 4 or 5%.
And this includes Point Thompson?
No. That would be in our under evaluation category, sir. So
that would be the next slide.
This next slide does show Point Thompson. The blue line here then would be a layer for under evaluation. So we have currently producing for the red line, we have under development for the green line, and we have under evaluation for the blue line. The projects under evaluation, I would not give them as much confidence in the production forecasts as we do as the under development and the currently producing, certainly. Now, if you look at this graph, I think it's probably wise to look at this in a little bit. If all investment were to stop tomorrow, all new projects were to stop tomorrow, I would project you would have, as far as production rates, would be the red line, or the currently producing data. So I would say that would be your worst-case scenario. If the price of oil plummeted to $5 a barrel, you'd probably lose a lot of investment on the North Slope. With the current plans and the current development, the green line is probably what we're going to see out in the North Slope production. The blue line indicates projects that are under evaluation, and that little bump around the year 2023 or so is the effect of Point Thompson. And in Point Thompson, we did assume that there was a gas sales pipeline for them to reach that level of production. If the gas sales line does not happen, the blue line would probably follow the green line down fairly closely, so there wouldn't be a bump in production as you see here.
And your first gas under that assumption is?
They're having two wells in 2014, I think it was. There's 10,000 barrels of oil per day there. There's no gas sales at that point, but the first gas sales we put out 10 years, I think it was, from today till about 2020.
Correct. We've always assumed a 10-year development lead time for Point Thompson and a gas line. So we assume 10 years.
But I think, hasn't that been kind of had the historic norm?
Yes.
Point Thompson's always 10 years out?
Yes. That's the benefit we get from one more year of history to add to our forecast.
Okay. And go ahead to the last graph here, Jenny, if you could. This is a similar graph that we've seen before, only it's on a log scale. Engineers like to look at things on log scales. And as you look at this, obviously Prudhoe Bay is the vast majority of production in this case. Unless another supergiant oil field is found out here, you're not going to see production rates as you've seen in the past. And it's fairly obvious, a giant being something in the order of Prudhoe Bay, before you can reach historical production rates.
So just to conclude, again, our forecasting requires consideration of each project's geology, the development plan, the commerciality, to determine what that production profile will be, the decline rate, and the timing of those projects. We use extensive well and field-specific data that we acquire from the AOGCC and DNR, as well as through discussions with the producers and the plans of development they submit. And our forecast is a roll-up of all wells to all fields that have been discovered, are currently producing, under development, under evaluation. With that, I can answer any more questions.
So the department will then come back with some additional information and on a more focused area from, and you can 2000 to 2020 or whatever your data, you can parse it out fairly easy. I suppose we need to pick up a couple of years previous to the implementation of PPT, and then forecast out a couple of years, 3-4 years ahead of us.
Senator Sinman, yes, we can certainly provide those to you.
Do you have any other questions for the department? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's probably highly unlikely we would find another Prudhoe at Prudhoe Bay, but or on the North Slope at all. But just the existence of the heavy oil at Prudhoe is more than double, in some estimations, particularly the one you referenced, of what has already been extracted. So obviously, I guess people look at the current technology and what's potentially available, but it's always kind of an idea of, you know, innovation is caused by desire and need, so to speak. So as we look forward to that, with all the facilities in place and then that being the real prize that's left, I don't know if this is a question or more just me trying to get it straight in my own mind. Obviously, we would be looking to encourage that development there and make sure that continues on, because it is already in an area where there is not a need for infrastructure. It already exists. So we reduce a great amount of the cost simply by what exists in place. It just, and not simply, but a matter of finding a way to raise that oil in a reasonable. And there are some discoveries that are coming online that are considered heavy oil, and I realize that is not a definite or a very finite definition of heavy. It's a broad range. Is that correct, of what is considered heavy oil?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's correct. There is a range.
All right. I guess
and we are certainly producing some heavy oil, or what is considered to be viscous or heavy oil, would be the Orion, Polaris, Schrader Bluff pools. But the real heavy stuff that probably you're thinking of is the Ugnew deposit, which is much shallower and much heavier.
Okay, thank you.
And then you'll bring back some data on the heavy oil. I think we also asked you about that.
Yes.
That's going to factor in the credit issue or production issue. Okay, seeing no other questions, we'll thank you for your presentation today, and we're going to take a brief at ease before we fire off with our second one. We're at ease. come back to order, please. We're going to pick up our second presentation today by the Department of Natural Resources regarding oil and gas activity, and to present for the Department of Natural Resources, we have Mr. Kevin Banks. Is that correct online? Mr. Banks?
It's Kevin Banks here, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Kevin. If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and walk us through this presentation.
I would be happy to, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And today what I will do is talk about some of the things that Ms. Duvall and her engineer were not talking about, because we're going to be looking a little bit to the more of the exploration side of things, the categories that were described as a little bit more iffy, but at least we'll give you a picture of what kinds of activities have been going on the North Slope, and with respect to things, you know, potential activities that may lead to more oil in the future. The map that you see on the screen above you, talk about a couple things that I overheard in the presentation and some of the questions. For example, we heard questions about the OCS, the offshore, as distinct from the outer continental shelf. You'll note in the that bright blue line that runs along the coast, that represents the three-mile limit from the coast. Everything to the south of that blue line is state submerged waters in the Beaufort Sea, and so that's land that we lease and get our royalties from. It is also land that is subject to, or oil production from there is subject to, taxes. North of that blue line is the Outer Continental Shelf, which is managed by the federal government. Production from those lands are not subject to state taxes. However, between the 3 mile and 6 mile limit, the state shares in the federal royalties to the tune of about 27% of the royalties that they collect on those lands. Now, what I'm going to do today is talk about some of the more recent activities, starting at 12 o'clock and then working around the clock to going through each of these text boxes. I will make an observation too. You will note that, and I hope you hope folks have maps at your desks, but you'll note that there are wells drilled in 2008 that are indicated in black, wells that are in orange that are wells drilled in 2009, and then wells, the red wells are permitted or planned for 2009 and upcoming in 2010 this winter. These are largely, these are wells that are exploration activities that we think of as exploration activities, some of which have been subject to tax credits as exploration wells, and but these are not necessarily the development type wells that we think about in the year-round activities within the existing units. So let's start with Brooks Range Petroleum. That would be the Beachy Point unit, which was formed just recently, and Brooks Range has spud the Sac River number 1A well into the Kuparik formation. They will be drilling some more into the North Shore number 3 well with a Sag River Ivishak formation. Just to let you know, the Ivishak is a formation that's similar to or an extension of the Prudhoe Bay formation of the main initial produce, participating area there. So that's some, as a new activity, it's a new entrant. Brooks Range is a new entrant on the North Slope, and they are stepping out into areas that have, where exploration occurred in the 80s, and are returning to an area that that the larger companies had decided not to pursue. And similarly, Ultrastar, which is in the Dewline unit, has begun, we'll plan on drilling a second Dewline well in a small unit just to the east of the Beachy Point unit. Both of these companies, Ultrastar and Brooks Range, you probably haven't heard much about, but they are a couple of our new explorers. As we go from left to right, we can comment a bit about Liberty. Liberty will soon begin drilling a disposal well to test the equipment, their new ultra extended reach drilling equipment there, and we anticipate drilling to begin in earnest for the wells, originating from an island that's part of the Duck Island unit on the what's called the satellite drilling island at Endicott, and those long reach ultra extended reach wells will drill from the state lands out to the OCS. As you can see, the little Liberty box there inside of a pocket of federal land that's surrounded on three sides by state land.
So, Mr. Banks, we don't get the normal tax activity for the Treasury under Liberty, is that correct?
That would be correct. There's no tax coming in for Liberty, and in fact, one of the complications for development of Liberty was to accept and a change in how we normally meter oil and gas liquids, because they will be processed in the oil and gas and water liquids that come up from Liberty will be processed at Endicott, and production will be allocated to the Liberty production. So Ms. Duvall had mentioned that we may see some efficiencies at Endicott because of the production in Liberty, which will contribute to perhaps lower costs for production of state oil, just as the economies of scales are improved. But there is no direct tax on production from the OCS.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Banks, you say there's no tax coming to the state. Is there a tax that goes to the North Slope Borough?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the answer to that question, I believe, is no. The property tax to the North Slope Borough will come to them because of improvements to the Endicott facilities and the addition of the, you know, the well heads and the equipment that will be placed on the satellite drilling island. So there are physical improvements that occur within the borough, which will be subject to property tax, but the wells themselves, bottom hole location, is outside of the borough. So therefore, some part of that will not be subject to property tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Banks, when we go forward, I think we're going to get into some employment issues later on in the presentation, and I'd like you to try to factor out the impact of Liberty.
In terms of the improved employment, yeah. I think just as a rule of thumb, I don't know how to estimate what the difference is for Liberty, but we can know that there is most of the employment will be in the drilling of the wells. Once the fluids begin to reach the surface and go into the Endicott facility, why then you have the workers there whose job it will be to manage both state and federal oil and gas. So their employment is enhanced because there's now more activity at the Endicott facilities than there would have been without Liberty.
Yeah, Mr. Banks, I apologize. I got ahead of myself on the next presentation.
That's okay.
So you're off the hook on this one.
Well, thank you. I know that jobs are important, but I don't do jobs that much. Good. As we head further to the east, Bedami, we've heard some pretty good news lately. BP is the owner and operator of Bedami. However, there has been arrangements made with Savant Alaska LLC, a small company out of Colorado that will be drilling, has drilled the Red Wolf well, and will be sidetracking and working on more drilling activities through the next several months, apparently successfully, because they anticipate restarting production at Badami by September this year, which is actually about 3 months sooner than we had expected even just a month ago. So good news at Badami. Perhaps that's another indication of what it means to have new entrants in the oil patch here, bringing different ideas and, in a sense, trying out new technologies. And even in this case, taking over for the operator the task of drilling, and in so doing, acquiring an interest in the unit. As we go to the Point Thompson text box, last week Exxon announced that they had struck total depth of PT-15, and that they were going to enter the PT-16 well that they had previously drilled to set casing in last winter. Those two wells will be completed before the winter season is done. I might add that in discussing production forecasts from Department of Revenue, when they refer to the Point Thompson production and the timing there, I'll just point out that the administration, the government, isn't a monolith in terms of knowing, in some cases, what the right hand is doing, the left hand and the right hand knowing what each other is doing. DOR has had to rely on public information with respect to Point Thompson and the production forecast and the impact of a major gas sale on gas sales from Point Thompson, rely on the public pronouncements from Exxon, both in its discussions with the public, but also in hearings before the Department of Natural Resources. So there, stay tuned on production forecasts for Point Thompson. As time goes on, those will become more precise. Winding around to the about the 6 o'clock into the middle part of the map, Chevron drilled 5 wells into what they call their White Hills program. They had originally permitted, I think, as many as 16 wells, drilled 3 in 2008 and 2 more in 2009, excuse me. There had been some discussion about unitizing the area, and those discussions have since quieted down. We don't have any information that we can share with you about the about those wells.
Mr. Brooks, if you can define unitizing.
Sorry, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unitization occurs where there is a need to consolidate land ownership and intended to preserve the best management of the resource, and also to assure that ownership of the resources is correctly allocated to our lessees. So if you think about, we offer up leases that are about, in this area anyway, about 5,700 acres each, and an area like those described by those 5 wells in the White Hills program is actually 30 or 40 leases, I think, and so that would have required, in order to develop this region from a single set of facilities, to make sure that the land rights of other lessees in the area were taken care of, DNR will allow that all the leases are combined into a single unit so that they are managed as almost like a single lease, and everyone's rights are taken care of and production is done efficiently. And so that's what unitization is. It is an area where DNR's responsibilities on state lands overlaps a little bit with the AOGCC. The Conservation Commission is also concerned about assuring that there is production of oil and gas without any waste and that the resource is conserved and that correlative rights of all of the landowners are maintained. So we have a sharing of responsibilities when it comes to unitization on state land. There's a note here with an arrow pointing south. We now know that fairly recently that Doyon has announced that it will be doing a seismic shoot in the Yukon Flats area. Much of that is going to be surface land owned by the federal government, but they own the mineral rights, and we can take that as good news. Just as an aside, should they be successful in developing oil and gas there, I think they would be subject to the tax rules that apply to Cook Inlet. Now at about the 7 o'clock point, there's just a shout out to the Department of Transportation. Today there is considerations of a couple of routes from the Hall Road to the Gubik and Umiat area. The division has contributed a little bit of information to DOT to try to indicate where the most attractive potential might exist along each of those routes so that they can pick a road route that will touch or have an influence on, or we call it the area of influence, for the most oil and gas resources. We will continue to do that kind of work as the project proceeds. Now we're going to move over to the west end of the North Slope and talk quite a bit about the NPRA. As you can see, the Anadarko, Petro-Canada, and BG have drilled three wells in the last three years in the NPRA at Gubik and at the Chandler well. Not on this map is also some mention of the Umiat oil field that was that is being worked by Renaissance LLC, a small group of investors who have shot seismic over their shallow oil field, which actually has fairly good quality oil, but because it is pretty far from infrastructure, it is clearly very challenged.
Mr. Brooks, could you just tell us what NPRA is?
I'm sorry, yes, I'd be happy to. The National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska was established way back when, in the 1910s, I believe. It was part of the oil reserves, the naval oil reserves that were established at places like Teapot Dome or Elk Hills in California. And the intention was to find areas under federal management that would serve the nation's needs for oil and gas, particularly for the Navy. It was managed by the Navy for many years until it was handed over, I think, in the 20s to the Department of Interior, and with some unfortunate results with the case of the Teapot Dome. But here in the National Petroleum Reserve, it's federal land still managed by the BLM. It has taken on a slightly different management goals. It's not just an oil and gas province anymore. There's also pretty strong multi-use provisions involved in its management, including a lot of conflicting uses for wildlife management and so forth. The area has been offered up for had considerable amount of drilling in the 50s, late 40s and 50s. As a consequence of that drilling, for example, the gas fields up near Barrow were discovered. Much of the areas that you see here on our map where drilling has occurred is sort of following on from the work that was done by the Geological Survey and the Navy, you know, hiring oil companies to look for oil during that period. Not much happened until the 1990s when the BLM began leasing land there with the expectation that they would offer leases in quadrants of the NPRA repeatedly on some kind of regular basis every 2 years. Those plans went awry because of litigation from environmental over environmental concerns, and have since been pretty challenged. So in spite of the activities that you see here for exploration, obviously the latest piece of news that we've heard on the CD5 satellite development has been delayed because of Corps of Engineer concerns and the denial of Conoco's permit to build a bridge across the Colville River Channel in response to the EPA, the federal EPA, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's opinion that the waterway had some national importance with respect to waterfowl. That is precisely the kind of access questions and issues that we have to deal with in this state. Much of the prospective areas in the North Slope lie under federal management, and they seem to have a different perspective about local employment than we do, and that the state's revenue picture and oil production prediction picture take a second seat behind national concerns for wildlife.
Yeah, Mr. Banks, before we get too far off subject, Liberty, we just discussed her a little bit ago being out of state waters. What's the tax difference between Liberty's treatment and NPRA?
Mr. Chairman, the taxes on the NPRA apply, so those wells, any production there will be subject to state production taxes. And for that matter, the state enjoys a 50% share of the royalties that are collected by the federal government there, although the federal government takes those royalties and bonus bids and so forth and puts them into an impact fund, and the state participates in a process in which the revenues from those lands are distributed to the communities that are affected by development there.
So it's more profitable for the state's treasury to develop NPRA than it is OCS?
On a barrel for barrel, yes, it is, because of the difference in tax and royalties. Okay. I might add, though, that there may be a lot more oil offshore than has been so far discovered in the NPRA. But
right.
NPRA is likely to occur sooner if we can get through the access issues.
Okay. Yeah, if you can continue with your presentation, please.
Very good. So I've mentioned Anadarko, Petro-Canada, and BG, and their activities around the Chandler and Wolf Creek and Gubik wells. I might add that these are gas-prone or gas prospects. They represent a kind of concept that we may see repeating itself throughout the foothills on lands further south than this map shows, between, say, the bottom border of this map and the Brooks Range. There's a lot of ASRC private land, and I know these companies have leasehold positions on ASRC land. We don't know very much about plans for those areas, but we believe that the kinds of targets that were drilled for in the Wolf Creek and in other areas is maybe similar to the ones that will be attractive in the foothills.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Banks, on the ASRC lands, who owns the subsurface rights there?
That is ASRC subsurface rights.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead and continue, Mr. Brooks.
Yes, sir. Now we move up north into the area that is the Greater Moose's Tooth unit and activities conducted by ConocoPhillips. These are basically step outs, in our opinion, from the activities that spurred or the lessons learned at Alpine, and we have we believe some expectations that the Scout well will be re-entered by 2012. I think that's an obligation under the Beartooth unit. ConocoPhillips has drilled the Grandview and Pioneer wells. Some of these wells, again, were subject to state tax credits, even though they occur on federal lands. And we see that there's been some success in finding oil there. It's a real challenge developing these areas or even testing the exploration wells since surface access is so limited. Some of the most expensive wells drilled on the North Slope have been drilled in the NPRA. I touched a little bit on CD5, which is the Alpine West satellite development. With the denial of the Corps of Engineer permit, we're basically on hold for activity there. I might add that in part, the reason this was moving forward to development, perhaps ahead of the exploration activities we've just described in the NPRA, is that it's already part of the Colville River unit, and the subsurface land in this part of the Colville River unit is owned by the ASRC. So this is another place where a private landowner will benefit from the development, even though the surface is run by the federal government. So now there'll be through the unitization and the unit agreements that apply at Colville River, the development of the Colville River unit is proceeded with shared ownership between the state and the ASRC. Much of the Alpine West development would have a much greater effect on royalty revenues for ASRC than they would the state. I have to tell you that our response and our concern about the Corps of Engineers' decision was something of a serious blow. I think it's an indication that the federal government must have thought that merely leasing this land was all they needed to do to assure development, but then failed to go the second step and allow oil companies to access their leases. I think it's an unfortunate trick that the federal government has played on the industry, if you don't mind me saying so, to attract industry in and then deny them the ability to develop their lands.
Mr. Banks, when you get done, maybe if you have the data, if you don't, maybe you can put it together for us. I'd like to know on your chart here, you've got wells drilled in 09 and 08 and permitted and planned for 9 and 10. I'd like to back up to maybe 05 or 04 and have that data brought to the committee along with the feet per year drilled.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the request. We were asked on Friday, in fact, by the Finance Subcommittee and the other body to provide similar information along with a narrative about what we were seeing has been evolving over time, and we will do that so that you'll get a picture of drilling activity on the North Slope. We're preparing charts, actually, that'll take you back quite a ways, but we'll provide some discussion of what's been occurring, say, in the last 5 or 10 years. As far as feet drilled per year, that'll be a little bit more of a challenge. I'd like to be able to give you the first part of that request before the day is out, and we'll work on the second part, if that's okay.
Okay, and again, we were going to try to focus on the last 4 or 5 years and the next 2 or 3 years so we don't get drowned in historic data that doesn't help us deal with the issue in front of the committee.
Yes, sir, we'll take care of that then. I might add, though, it's as far as the next 2 years, a lot of the information on this map is somewhat anecdotal. It is in part because the information that we discuss with the companies was the case also for the Department of Revenue is based on plans. Some plans don't work out. we don't see much ahead, much more than a year ahead in terms of plans of exploration, plans of development within each of the units. As you step out further and further forward, the companies are more and more reluctant to discuss their plans for fear that the state will mistake a plan for a commitment. And although we assure them that that's not the case, that occasionally happens. But we'll do what we can in terms of giving you something of a forecast, at least as far in the future as we can. As we head up north or into the region around the Park River, Brooks Range Petroleum plans to drill North Tarn number 1 on a lease that they share with Eni, or the Italian oil company. And we see also that Pioneer has moved forward with development at the Ugruk project, drilling into the Nuiqsut and Kuparuk participating areas now that as an indication of progress there, the Ugruk field is turning out to be a field that was challenged at first. The first wells drilled there were complicated and difficult, but each well provided a lesson for the next. And I think Pioneer is pretty happy with the progress of the Ugruk project. And finally, we get back to Eni's Nikaichuk unit with expectations that first oil will be developed there by the end of this year. Eni, by the way, had postponed their original plan was to have production going by now, but because of the broader economic decline and commitments that they had and didn't have much control over elsewhere in the world, they fell back from a fairly accelerated schedule to a schedule that was a little bit more normal for the North Slope. But activity has started again at the Ayachuk project.
Senator Egan, did you have a question?
Yeah, like, Mr. Chair, I'm just confused.
Pull the mic in, please.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Kevin,
yes, sir.
Can you explain multi-phase metering to me?
Well, we'll have somebody that knows more about it than I do explain it to both of
us. Okay.
Mr. Brooks, could you explain multi-phase metering, please?
Multi-phase metering occurs where you have water, gas, and oil mixed together and flowing through a device that will tell you how much of each component is flowing through the pipe. Normally, when we meter oil production for the purposes of royalties or allocations and what have you, all we're metering is the fluid, the oil, or the gas that would be subject to some kind of royalty or is going to be sold or put in a pipeline somewhere. And that's normally done with a fairly mechanical device, and the accuracy of those meters is pretty high. What we have now occurring here at particularly Ugruk, and it will occur when Liberty comes online, is fluids all mixed together and a machine that will have to meter all three fluids and then parse out which fluid is which. You can imagine what those fluids look like as they flow through the pipeline. Sometimes they'll be foamy slugs of gas and water. Sometimes oil will be flowing through. So the precision of a multi-phase meter is somewhat less than the basic lease acquisition custody transfer meters that we normally see on the North Slope. But with appropriate checking and testing against other kinds of devices, the state, the companies, AOGCC are coming to gain more confidence and are willing to use multi-phase metering in situations where the fluids will be blended with processing in already built facilities and not built for purpose for the particular project that the wells are supplying.
Thanksgiving. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and continue, Mr. Brooks.
I might add also that the last box that I've got here is continued year-round development drilling. I've talked to you've heard some questions about heavy oil production, and I hope that DOR can prepare for you something of a forecast. I think that Ms. Duvall did a very good job of explaining the potential for heavy oil on the North Slope, 20 billion barrels of oil in place or more, but that production there may, if it's only 2%, that's 400 million barrels, up to 15% or 3 billion barrels of oil. It is a challenged resource, obviously, but once the wells are drilled in these areas, production tends to flatten out pretty well. It just depends on the number of wells that are penetrating the heavy oil sands. And let me just make it clear for those who know about this, but and hear and read about heavy oil elsewhere and development elsewhere. This is not like tar sands. It's not even like California heavy oil. It's actually better quality than what we see in other parts of the country that require either introducing heat into the reservoir in order to produce it, or actually digging it out of the ground, as would be the case in northern Alberta. Our heavy oil is actually a slightly better quality oil. It's not nearly so heavy as what is being produced in places around the world, but because it's heavier than what we're producing today, we just assign it the nickname heavy oil. But as I said, it is a challenged resource, and but I think it is the next phase for development in the existing oil fields on our slope.
Mr. Banks, when you bring back the data on the wells drilled for the last 5 or 6 years or so, and then a forecast out for the next year, could you try to pinpoint what's infield drilling in Prudhoe and Kuparuk and Alpine amongst that analysis, and if you can get feet drilled, if you have any of that data?
Yes, sir. We'll give it a try. That concludes the North Slope outlook and activities that we've seen in the last year and what we expect to see in the coming year. I'm prepared to discuss, flip to the next map.
And Mr. Banks, we're going to want to pick the pace up a little bit.
Well, and I think that's probably appropriate given the fact that Cook Inlet's probably not of direct interest in many of the discussions about taxes here, except for more specific legislation that's designed to manage for new gas supply. The activities in the Cook Inlet are, I'll just hit on a couple of high points. The geothermal project at about 10 o'clock in the map. You can see the leases there up at Mount Spur. Minimal exploration was conducted by Ormat last summer season, and they have submitted, as according to the requirements of their leases, exploration plans for this coming season. They have talked about the potential there of developing a fairly large power plant in the neighborhood of 50 to 100 megawatts, which would represent about a quarter of the electric demand in the...
Mr. Banks, if I could derail you a little bit. Our concentration is going to be on oil production and credits.
Sorry.
So we want to stay concentrated on the issue at hand. Although
okay.
Some of these issues within Cook Inlet are very important to energy and in the rail belt and heating our homes and running our city, but that's not the issue in front of the committee.
Okay, very good. I'll just hit on a few things then. At about 11 o'clock, there's a text box referring to the Rampart Energy Company's well at Nunavak number 1 in the Nanana Basin. That was a project that involved Doyon on an exploration license there. The well was drilled last summer. It's probably the most, it was one of the most wildcat wells drilled in the state in a very long time, and we'll have to wait and see what the results of that were. Rudder Wilbanks was drilling wells, or re-entered its Otna number 119 well. It's a prospect that was also under a license with the state and drilled up now on Native Corporation land in that region. That was plugged and abandoned in September last year. Activities in the Cook Inlet that are most interesting to me are the Sunrise and Shadura prospects near Swanson River. The Marathon, as I understand it, has begun drilling the Sunrise well. That's one of the first exploration wells drilled in the Cook Inlet in a long time. And Shadura is, depending on investment dollars, is another potential gas play to the west of the Swanson River, drilled by an independent company called Nordex. We've talked about gas storage in both bodies this year, and that there's an evaluation underway, and the Department of Natural Resources is currently in discussions with the sponsors there, CINGS and their ANR project, NSTARS project. If we head south onto the Cook Inlet, Pioneer is working on the Hanson 1A well and began testing that well about 2 weeks ago, which is one of the few activities that Pioneer is conducting nationwide is the work at Cosmopolitan. I think their business is starting to pick up again, but when the price of gas fell so dramatically a year or so ago, the only activity Pioneer was sanctioning was here in Alaska. North Fork is a project sponsored by Armstrong. For those of you that don't know who Armstrong is, Armstrong is the company that basically put together the prospect at Ugarook and Nikaichuk and then flipped it to the companies Pioneer and ENI, who are now the operators of those fields. Armstrong is a very capable explorer. They know how to put together a prospect, prove it up, and then find appropriate investors to develop it. But in the case of North Fork, they are moving ahead with this as a producer. The consequence of this development will be a pipeline that will flow from Anchor Point to Nanelchik. It will be built by NSTAR, and Armstrong will construct a pipeline from North Fork to Anchor Point to connect to that pipeline. So that's good news for the folks on the southern part of the Kenai, although the gas will enter an NSTAR pipeline and flow to users throughout the Cook Inlet. It means that infrastructure is reaching down into an area of the Kenai that has not yet been developed, and we anticipate potential growth down there in gas plays. Lastly, I think I'll touch on the kitchen lights unit, and which is the operator there will be Escapeda, and they are telling us that they will bring a jackup rig into the Cook Inlet to drill for an oil target in the kitchen lights unit as a preliminary exploration program. We await to see if they will be affected by any kind of critical habitat issues. But from our expectations, the Escapeda is committed to have a rig under contract by June 30th and drilling their first well before December 31st of this year. With that, I think I better wrap it up. I feel like you guys are hoping that I'll stop talking and get on to the next.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Banks. There's a lot of information there. But we'd like you to help us try to sort out how much drilling has been done in Prudhoe Park and Alpine relative to the other fields in the North Slope. As you put that data together, there might be other information that you have that will help the committee separate those two issues. And for those watching at home, Prudhoe Park and Alpine is where most of the oil and most of the revenue for the state is.
Yes, sir, I'll try to do that.
Any questions for Mr. Banks? Thank you, Mr. Banks. We have one more presentation. We're going to take a brief at ease. Here, we're going to go ahead and recess till 1:30 today. We'll pick up with the next presentation from the Department of Labor on workforce development. Should take 20 minutes to half hour or so, and then we'll have an hour roughly on transportation dealing with TAPS, which will keep us pretty much on schedule. So we'll see everybody back at 1:30. We're at recess.